The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm producer K.O. Myers. This week, our host Desiree Shell looks at the lighter side of science, both real and imagined. A little later, researcher and blogger PsyCurious returns to tell us about some more of her favorite posts in her Friday Weird Science series. And Desiree will talk to Phil Edwards, creator of the hysterical and occasionally controversial Fake Science website and textbook. But first, Desiree talks to a collector of some of the most improbable real science ever conducted.
I'm here with Mark Abrahams, the editor and co-founder of the science humor magazine Annals of Improbable Research and the author of the weekly Guardian column Improbable Research. Mark is also the father and master of ceremonies of the Ig Nobel Prize ceremony, and he has a new book out, This is Improbable: Cheese String Theory, Magnetic Chickens, and Other WTF Research. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So you collect improbable research. What is that?
I collect things, all kinds of things that have a particular quality. These are things that make people laugh and then think. And research is a funny, sometimes intimidating word. But to me, research just means somebody's trying to make sense of something. Somebody's trying to find out as much about something as they can. So no matter what they're trying to make sense of, and no matter who they are, whether they are officially some sort of scientist or a kid or anything else, if they're trying to truly make sense of something, then for me that's research. And if it's funny and it makes people think after they've laughed, then I might want to write about it.
Now, a lot of the research that you do write about is, yes, hilarious, but some of it is actually pretty important as well, correct?
That's probably true. Well, I try to just write about the stuff as it is and not get into the business of commenting on whether I think it's good or bad or important or not. I like to think if I write about it clearly enough, then if it is good or if it's bad or if it's anything else, the thing itself should make that clear.
Where do you find these wonderful studies?
Everywhere. I'm always looking for things. And I've been doing this for a long time now, for more than 20 years. So I'm always reading all sorts of stuff. Other people connected with the magazine are always looking for things. Our readers are always looking for things. And these days it feels like half the world is looking for things. And there don't seem to be all that many people who really are interested in listening to these stories at first. So people have more and more taken to sending them to me. I'm always happy to see them. And sometimes it just takes setting them into a little bit of context or changing the words so they're no longer the 5-mile long words in the original version of something, but nice, clear, simple words that once people see that, then a lot of people will decide, hey, this is kind of interesting.
Well, I love that you've actually kept track of these things, because I have a feeling that some of this research would just be lost to the depths of time if you didn't collect it.
I have a feeling you're right. That's true of pretty much everything. You know, think about, there are, 7 billion people roughly in the world, but think about just the people that you know, just the people you've met. In fact, think about just the people you've met in the last 10 years. How much do you know about what they've actually done day to day? Probably almost everything that all of those people have done is a complete mystery to you and to almost everybody else. So yeah, things happen. Sometimes wonderful things happen and almost no one notices.
That was deep, sir.
Sorry about that.
Now, you had the brilliant idea, and I definitely think it was brilliant, to actually give out awards for the best improbable research. So tell us about the awards.
I would say for the most improbable. And by improbable, I mean it's unexpected. It should hit you as something that you never had any reason to think about this, probably. And I'm sorry, what was your question?
Well, tell me about the categories, because they're similar to the Nobels.
Yeah, we give out 10 Ig Nobel Prizes a year, and we get something these days like 9,000 or so new nominations every year. We have a category for each prize, but the categories change. They roughly parallel the Nobel categories, but we are always inventing categories to fit something that doesn't fit. We almost always have a physics prize, a chemistry prize, a biology prize, a medicine prize. We always have a peace prize, the Ig Nobel Peace Prize, literature prize most years, often an economics prize. But we'll make things up. One of the categories, here's the one that over the span of, I guess, 22 years now, I remember this one as being the most difficult to fit into any category, and we finally invented it. It was the prize we gave to someone you may remember, a proud Canadian like yourself, name of Troy Hurtubise, who lives in North Bay, Ontario. Troy is the guy who has spent many years building and personally testing a suit of armor that he hopes will protect him against grizzly bears.
I was thinking Americans, but that's fair.
I'm sure it's a multi-purpose suit. I don't know how he would have tested it for that specifically. But anyway, if you were going to give a prize to Mr. Hurtubise for doing that, what category would you put it in?
Oh, my. Do tell, sir.
We had many arguments, and we finally came up with a category that we're happy with. So he got the prize in, I believe, 1999. It may have been 98, but somewhere around there, for safety engineering.
Of course. Now, is that what, I believe it was the winner of last year's Ig Nobel's, it was the bra that doubled as a gas mask?
That was, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. Dr. Elena Bodnar. She invented a brassiere that in an emergency can be quickly converted into a pair of protective face masks.
Now, what category was that?
We gave her the Ig Nobel Prize in Public Health.
Oh, very nice.
And the history of that, like many of the Ig Nobel Prizes, was a lot more interesting than you might expect when you hear just the little citation. She is a doctor. She grew up in Ukraine. She was, as a very young doctor, one of the people who treated a lot of victims of the Chernobyl power plant meltdown, including a lot of children. And she and some of the other doctors have stayed in touch with each other over the years and kept an eye on how things developed. And they realized, she said, after quite a while, that the majority of the medical problems from Chernobyl were not from the radiation that hit people's skin. Most of the really bad stuff was from the particles that were in the air that people breathed in. So she had been thinking for years about what might have been different, what could have been different that would have prevented a lot of those medical problems. She kept thinking if there were just some kind of simple face mask, just a piece of cloth, that would have made a great difference. And then one day she realized, well, in most of the world, if you have a group of people, about half of them are wearing a piece of cloth that's just about perfectly suited in many ways. And so she invented the emergency bra.
See, and that's why I say some of this is very valuable.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
At least one. And this year, actually, I wanted to mention one of this year's winners was for the Neuroscience Prize. And that was for demonstrating that brain researchers, by using complicated instruments and simple statistics, can see meaningful brain activity anywhere, even in a dead salmon.
That's correct.
Please explain.
Did you have a question about that?
Many.
Yeah, these are four scientists who do a lot of research involving brains and scanning machines, which will make images of some of the electrical activity inside a brain at any particular moment. These are very complicated machines, and inside the workings of them are based on some fairly complicated mathematics and some pretty complicated electronics. The signals that come out of these things are also very complicated, and interpreting what they mean is by no means straightforward. If people are not extremely careful, there are all kinds of signals that will come out of this thing. All kinds of, you may have seen beautiful pictures of activity in brain.
Right.
But figuring out what those pictures mean, how those correspond to what the brain is doing, what we think the brain is doing, there's an awful lot of disagreement about that. Brains are very mysterious still. And an awful lot of the reports that have been published by an awful lot of scientists apparently were done by not being as careful as they should have been about interpreting those things. So these scientists wanted to demonstrate how easy it is when you get a beautiful picture of brain activity to read too much into what you're seeing. And what they did was take a dead salmon and stick it inside the machine where they usually stick people and take pictures just like the ones they normally have and point out that an awful lot of the little points on the picture that you might interpret as meaning that part of the brain is thinking about something, the part to the left is doing something, that an awful lot of those things really are just random. It's just random, but if you weren't very, very careful, you might delude yourself into assuming that they mean something. And so just proceeding the same way almost anybody would if they were not being extremely careful, they analyzed the brain activity of the dead salmon, and they found that if you're not extremely careful, you're likely to assume that a lot of what you see is actual thinking going on, even in a dead salmon. As a result of this, they've told me that in the years since they did this work and since it started getting a lot of publicity in that scientific specialty, the number of reports, they've looked at them, that make these kinds of, call them sloppy interpretations, that the number of reports making that kind of sloppy stuff have gone way down. The percentage has gone way down. That apparently people are being a lot more careful. And it may be in large part because people have taken the lessons to heart that were taught to them by this story of the dead salmon.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking with Mark Abrahams, author of This Is Improbable, Cheese String Theory, Magnetic Chickens, and Other WTF Research, and the father of the Ig Nobel Prizes. So with so many award winners and even more that you've written about in The Guardian, how did you choose which studies to include in your book?
It wasn't easy. You know, I've been a lot of what's in the book, most of what's in the book does come from columns I wrote for the newspaper. And then for many of them, I went back when it was time to do the book and did some more looking about, what have these people done since I wrote about them? And some of them had done quite a bit. Essentially, I just picked a lot of them that were my favorites, and that included a lot of random picks because I only write about the things that appeal to me to begin with. So it was a lot of fun going back and looking at these things.
Well, tell us about some of your favorites. Or is that like picking children? I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's easier to talk about if you just name some of these kids, and then I'm happy to.
Oh, I have a whole bunch. Okay, let's start with The Economic Art of Suicide. That was fascinating research.
Yeah, that was done by, I think there were two or three authors, but the main one is a professor named David Lester. David Lester has, at this point, let me back up a little bit. Most people in academia, most professors, publish papers in academic journals for many reasons, but one of the reasons is that's how people get promotions. That's how people get raises. They're often judged in large part on how many things they publish. Now, to publish a good paper, most academics would tell you there's a tremendous amount of work. And if they publish three or four papers a year, that's a tremendous year. That's a huge amount of work that goes into these things. Okay, three or four a year. Professor David Lester has at this point published more than 2,000 academic papers. There are years in which he's published several hundred, and he's quite proud of that. I noticed him quite a while ago, and I started writing about him, and I've written about him several times because he's always writing all kinds of things. They span all sorts of subject ranges, but a lot of them, maybe two-thirds or more of his reports, have to do one way or another with one particular subject, and that subject is suicide. A lot of those reports are short, one or two pages long. Right. He'll go and he'll get some statistics and write about them. One of my favorites is, I think the title of that paper is something like Suicide on the Delaware Bridge. It's about people who committed suicide by jumping from the Delaware Bridge. And the main conclusion inside this paper is most of the people who committed suicide by jumping from the Delaware Bridge were from Delaware.
Wow.
All right, now that's not all that unusual a kind of paper for Professor Lester, but he produces a lot of stuff. One of his papers, which is longer than most of the others, and I think he did do it in combination with one or two other people. He likes to team up with others. Was about suicide of the effect of a particular suicide on the earnings of the person who died. Because after a person is dead, their estate lives on and their relatives inherit and all that stuff. And this particular person he looked at was a musician named Kurt Cobain, who you may remember. And he did some calculations about what kind of career financially Kurt Cobain might have been expected to have had he lived, compared with the amount of money that has come in since he died, perhaps partly spurred by the effects of being a celebrity. And the paper that Professor Lester wrote makes the argument that for some celebrities, Kurt Cobain being one, that at least financially, dying was an extremely good career move.
That's an intensely morbid field right there. Brilliant. Okay, I think I have time to mention one more. There's so many I want to talk to you about.
Pick the third one on your list.
The third one?
Whatever it is.
Oh, you're good. I like this one. Chapter 7. It combines sex and politics, which is always fascinating. It looks at German reunification after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. Oh, yeah. So what happened when the East and West Germans suddenly had access to each other's pants?
Yeah, and the interior thereof. There, on both sides of the wall, there was a lot of anticipation, you know, a lot of built-up fantasies. And after a number of years, the person who wrote this report went and started talking to people and gathering whatever statistics were available, and came to the strong conclusion that, in fact, there never was much difference, and there wasn't much difference after the wall fell. But everybody, or at least lots of people in West and East Germany, had all kinds of illusions about the other group before the dissolving of the wall. And afterwards, they still maintained sort of wistful hopes that some of those fantasies might be true. But what you can really boil down to, what the report really said, was that very few people in Germany, probably like very few people, as is the case almost everywhere, very few people's sex lives come anywhere near what their fantasies would lead them to hope.
Oh, Mark, thank you so much for being here. And everyone, just go buy this book, honestly.
Oh, thank you for having me on. Thank you for the kind words.
I love it. You will find links to Mark Abrahams in his book, This is Improbable, Cheese String Theory, Magnetic Chickens, and Other WTF Research, which I have to say is the best title of a book ever, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com.
We'll be right back with researcher and blogger Cy Curious for a look at some Friday weird science after this. Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Cy Curious, postdoctoral researcher with professional interests in neurophysiology. She's the author of the blog Neurotic Physiology, which boasts the brilliantly funny series of blog posts, Friday Weird Science. Cy, welcome back, lady.
Thank you so much for having me on. Always really fun.
When you and I talk about Friday Weird Science, it's always difficult to figure out whether I should start off like with the general weird and work people up to the sex or maybe hook people in with the sex and save the farting for later.
You'd like to think that maybe you could work them in, but sometimes I think you just got to be like, you know, semen. And then just, you know, if they're going to stay, they're going to stay.
Exactly. Okay, well, let's, you know, this is what we'll start with then. You wrote a post called, "This Quail Has a Cloth Fetish." What are we talking about here?
It's actually very interesting from a behavioral conditioning point of view, but it's also interesting because it has quails humping washcloths, which is always interesting, regardless of the science involved. The authors were interested in creating an animal model of a sexual fetish. And you might think, you know, a sexual fetish seems kind of like a uniquely human thing.
Right.
Well, you would think that until you see a turtle humping a shoe.
Right.
I mean,
I've seen that video.
A video never gets old. But it is a kind of a uniquely human concept. It's the idea of being sexually aroused in response to something that is not normally considered sexually arousing. But you have to take into account that what is considered normally sexually arousing has varied greatly over time and with regards to culture and various other things.
Right.
It's very culturally conditioned. I mean, you know, in China several hundred years ago, the foot was considered amazingly sexy, and now the foot's a fetish. So it really does vary over time. But they are interested in creating an animal model of this because, you know, there are some things that are definitely fetishes in that if you meet someone and they say, I'm sexually attracted to feet, you can say, well, yeah, you know. But if you meet someone and they say, I'm sexually attracted to lettuce, you know, there are some things that are just not considered generally sexually attractive objects, but some people are attracted to them anyway. This behavior, the sexual fetish, is thought to be learned. And it's thought to be learned during the period when people are expanding the range of what they consider to be sexually arousing, aka when they first see porn when you're about 13.
Hmm.
During the formative years, it can be anywhere between, you know, the onset of puberty to, like, 18. You can probably develop it fully in adulthood. But they wanted to study the concept of a sexual fetish, but it's really hard to study in humans. Yes, we'd like to recruit 21 adult males, and we'd like to give them a fetish for lasagna.
Okay, I see your problem.
This will not be remotely psychologically damaging. And they will never be able to correctly enter an Italian restaurant, you know, in the rest of their lives. So, you know, there are problems associated with that. So they decided to create an animal model of a fetish. And this is to study both how sexual fetishes form, but it's also to study, you know, if people wish to get rid of their sexual fetish, they could work on that. But it's also to study things like, for example, erectile dysfunction. You can use a sexually conditioned model like this to study changes in response to, you know, erectile dysfunction drugs and stuff like that.
Okay, so what did they do?
Well, so there are three components to a fetish. So there has to be sexual gratification. It has to be persistent. Even when it's no longer directly connected with sex, it has to happen. And it has to be the preferred method of completion. You can't just feel, you know, kind of happy walking into an Italian restaurant. You have to be face down in that lasagna. So they were trying to create this model. And so they took these little Japanese quail. They're very small and they're really cute and fluffy. And what they did was they did a basic behavioral conditioning where they have a cue. In this case, the cue was a light. And when they saw the light, a door would open and they would get access to a lovely lady quail.
Mm-hmm.
But half of the quail got the cue light in the presence of a, and I quote, terry cloth object, which I suppose could be like kind of a doll, but I'm imagining a washcloth. They weren't specific about what it was, but it appears to be a towel. And so they basically, if you always pair the cue with a stimulus, you get something called, you know, a conditioned stimulus. So the terry cloth object, the cloth, will serve in place of the cue. And so when they see that, they'll be like, all right, it's time for hot, sexy times. This is very common Pavlovian conditioning. And so you can actually get a sexual response in the quail to the terry cloth object in anticipation of getting the female.
I have a look on my face. You can't see it because it's the radio.
Well, then they take the female away. So you don't get the female anymore. You just get the washcloth. And it turns out this actually persisted. Even after the lady quail were no longer available, the washcloth group continued to vigorously hump terry cloth objects.
Success! And,
they have persistence, and they have the sexual gratification. The quails are humping the washcloths. The other thing that needs to happen is that it has to be preferred. This did not happen in all cases. Most of the quails, given the opportunity, just went, straight for that female and, left the washcloth. But a couple of the quail did not. A couple of the quail, said, "Sorry, lady, I'm busy with this washcloth."
So on what basis does a quail decide to continue to prefer a washcloth over the lady quail?
They don't know. They have created this model. I actually wonder if once the quail get past a certain stage in the mating game, there's a stereotyped behavioral sequence that takes over. And if that's the case, they probably can't stop halfway through and switch.
Indeed.
But the whole paper was just about the creation of this model. And presumably somewhere there will be internet videos of quails humping terry cloth objects.
Well, and let's just be clear. Even the authors said that this research couldn't be directly applied to humans.
No, it's not the same. The creation of a sexual fetish in a human is a much more complex situation. I mean, there's often a lot of, emotional salience, things like that. And maybe these quail are having amazing emotional experiences with washcloths, but you don't really want to assume that. So it's definitely a model used for, they want to use it to study erectile dysfunction primarily, but they also want to use it to look at how they can reduce the conditioned stimulus of the washcloth.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and today I'm talking to Cy Curious, author of the blog Neurotic Physiology, home to some of the weirdest science on the internet. So the next story I wanted to talk about was actually something that kind of began here on Skeptically Speaking. We had Kate Clancy on the show to talk about menstruation, and I love that episode. And someone in the audience asked about the old warning that you sometimes hear about how you shouldn't go out into the woods or camping or such when you have your period, because the bears can, I guess, smell it?
The bears can smell the menstruation.
Right. And I thought that was a strange question, but you both did blog posts on this, I believe. And it turns out, for anybody who didn't listen to that episode, I'll clear that up right now, there is no evidence for that idea. But it seems to have been the catalyst for both of you guys actually looking into what kinds of animals might be able to sense that. And you have a winner.
You have to assume that a great number of animals can indeed smell the menstruation. The more important question is whether or not they care. Because the bears can probably smell the menstruation. Do they care? No. In general.
Right.
However, snakes care.
Of course they do.
Or at least the brown tree snake cares. So if you're in Guam, hide your tampons. Because this study, I have to say, it's not a very good study. But it's a hilarious study. Because it has pictures of snakes eating tampons. And sometimes
you have to go look at her blog post. Okay, let's go back to why this is so hilarious on so many levels. What gave researchers the idea that a snake might be able to sense menstrual blood in the first place?
Okay, so there were a bunch of, these are brown tree snakes. They are native to Guam. And there were a series of brown tree snake attacks on babies in Guam. And the authors hypothesized that the snakes were attempting to eat the babies, obviously delicious babies, and wanted to know why. And so the hypothesis is that, well, snakes are attracted to the smell of blood, so the snakes must be finding the babies because the mothers are leaving their dirty tampons in the trash.
In the baby's room?
Which I have to wonder if any of these people had wives or babies. So they took a whole bunch of these brown tree snakes, and apparently these snakes are generally just a nuisance. But the way they're described is absolutely horrifying. They're nocturnal, giant nighttime snake. It is between 3 and 6 feet long, so it's a big nighttime snake. It lives in trees. It has teeth. It can inject venom, which is dangerous to babies in particular, but it's not dangerous to humans, like adults. And it weighs down things like power lines by sitting on them and can cause power outages. So all I could think of when I pictured this snake was, oh my God, it's this huge snake and it's going to come and cut the power and it's going to sneak up on through the trees. It's going to drop on your head and envenom you to death.
And then steal your tampons.
And then it will steal your tampons and your babies. No, apparently it's just kind of a nuisance. They have to keep it away from babies and small kids. So yeah, so they took these 10 captive brown tree snakes and they presented the snakes with used or unused tampons. And they just kind of dangled the tampon in front of the snake. And went and took photos and waited to see what the snakes did. And they were looking for things like chemosensing, which is where a snake flicks its tongue out to, you know, sense chemicals in the air. They looked to see if they could advance toward the tampon, etc. But the snakes were not allowed to strike at the tampons because apparently trying to get a bloody tampon away from a snake is really hard.
Ugh.
And apparently it was because the snakes went straight for the tampons anyway.
But really, okay, so this is, yes, not a good study on several levels. But even though they found that the snakes would more often chemosense the used tampons, they didn't use regular blood as control, so really this could apply to any kind of blood, right?
Yeah, it could be any blood. Yeah, I mean, you know, nobody offered to open a vein for science here, which you have to sit there and go, come on, it's not that hard. Just take a tampon, open a vein, and go. But not all scientists are willing to sacrifice. But basically, the moral of the story is apparently don't leave your postpartum blood and menstrual blood around your baby. You know, I still can't get behind it, because snakes, they have chemosensing, yes. They can probably smell the menstruation, sure. But more importantly, they can sense heat. Do you want to go for a cold, bloody tampon or a delicious, warm baby?
Right, we should have actually specified these were not recently used
no,
tampons.
I... You know, and given the choice between, you know, old tampon and warm baby, I know which I would prefer, personally.
Really?
I can tell you which one I'd prefer to hold. As for eating, well, I haven't got a lot of experience.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and today I'm talking to Cy Curious, author of the blog Neurotic Physiology, and we're talking about her Friday Weird Science series of blog posts. Okay, let's get away from the sex-ish things. Okay, you have blogged about why asparagus makes your urine smell odd, and maybe just give us a little bit of background on that, because then we can get to the story that I really want to talk about.
So I love that asparagus makes your urine smell odd. Well, I mean, I love it until I eat asparagus, and it makes it smell this kind of odd, musty. I believe the blogger Hermitage described it as smelling like zombie genitalia, and I think that's about right. So basically, asparagus makes your pee smell because during the metabolism of asparagus in the body, and not everybody does this, but a large proportion of the population can produce various sulfur compounds from the digestion of asparagus. Those get into your urine, and your urine smells odd and sulfurous.
Not everyone can smell the asparagus in someone's pee. Now, I have never heard that before, ever.
Well, so it turns out there's actually two polymorphisms here. There's a polymorphism first where you don't produce the asparagus pee. So some people can, you know, eat asparagus on dates and not be horribly embarrassed if they use the person's bathroom later. So you have that population. But there's also separate populations which cannot smell the asparagus pee. And at first I was like, oh, well, maybe, and I think this is entirely possible, maybe these people are just less sensitive smellers, period. So what they did was they actually took a large population of people. And what was interesting was they took like 300 something people and presented them with various dilutions of the urine of a man who had been forced to eat 350 grams of asparagus. This is a lot of asparagus. Was it 350? It might have been more. 450. Half a kilogram almost of asparagus for science. Ugh. I pity this man. Anyway, they collected a whole bunch of urine samples that were probably pretty potent. And they presented it to over 300 subjects. And what was interesting about this was they actually conducted the study in Israel. And Israel does not have a large amount of asparagus grown in it. So most people there at the time had never had asparagus. So they wouldn't know what they were smelling if they smelled something funny.
That is brilliant.
Which is an important blinding condition. And then, of course, for control, they had a couple of groups of Americans who were self-identified as being able to smell the asparagus, and a whole bunch who were also self-identified as not being able to smell it. So basically, when it comes to straight, undiluted urine, the hardcore, this guy ate almost half a kilogram of asparagus, oh, everyone can smell that. But once you get out into the dilutions, it actually breaks down into a bimodal distribution. Basically, on the graph, you have like a large hump of people who can smell it at very high concentrations. But there's also a small hump of people who can smell it at low concentrations. And it's actually a pretty small proportion. So out of the over 300 people, they had about 30 people that could smell at the high dilutions.
And we attribute that to genetics?
Yes. They did not actually do the genetics. I wish they had. I wish...
Isolating the asparagus pea-smelling genes?
Well, there's probably a specific receptor. I'm not sure which receptor it would be because this is not my area. But there's probably a specific receptor and probably a polymorphism in that that renders someone more sensitive. I would be interested, though, they did not compare it with other strong smells. So I'd be interested to actually know if the people, maybe these people are just really good smellers, period.
That's kind of unfortunate. I was hoping that we could actually have a gene called the asparagus pea-smelling gene because they, you know, people who name genes have named them an awful lot of interesting things, and I support that.
Yeah, you'd have to call it something more, I don't know, sciencey sounding than pea smelling. But
there's a Sonic Hedgehog gene.
That's true. I do love the Sonic Hedgehog gene.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Cy Curious, postdoctoral researcher and author of the blog Neurotic Physiology. Amongst many other pursuits, Cy collects the weirdest science that she can find for your reading pleasure.
The weirdest and the most wonderful.
Yes, that's obviously inferred. Okay, so, and you actually do, you write posts on the things that I'm interested in, and that's even if I didn't know that I was interested in them before. So the next thing that I want to talk about is actually something that I've been wondering about for years. Do humans have mating seasons? Because there do seem to be some seasonal trends, right?
Yes, there are seasonal trends. Most particularly, there are seasonal trends in things like when babies are born. So there's like a big rash of fall babies, which you would probably notice when you see like on your Facebook, you know, when you see like all the birthdays.
Right.
Babies are conceived more frequently in December. And there's also an increase in abortion in December.
I had no idea.
But there's also a bimodal peak in the winter and the summer, if you go by condom sales and by the diagnosis of STDs.
Wow.
So this particular paper hypothesized that we have mating seasons. We mate in the winter and we mate in the summer. I think that they might be correct, and I think it might be a cultural thing. Biologically, I don't think we really do. Or at least if we do, it's not mediated by the things they're hypothesizing. What they're looking at is they actually did a keyword search. So they checked the number of Google searches for various keywords, some of which were sexually related and some of which were not, to see if humans were seeking out mating. And it wasn't just sex, it was actually mating. So they compared, you know, things like erotic sites, porn sites, but they also compared, like, people, you know, how many people set up profiles on Match.com.
Right.
And they compared that to things that show no seasonal distribution. So pictures of kittens, pictures of puppies, cars, things like that.
So what did they find?
What they found was that, indeed, the keyword searches for dating websites, people were more likely to set up Match.com profiles in the winter and in the summer. They were slightly more likely to look for porn sites. Though it's very funny because there's actually a major trough in the fall of 2009 in search for porn sites, and then a major spike in 2010. I really wonder what happened.
That's what I was wondering. They didn't look into that?
They didn't look into that. I'm like, was it really depressing?
I know. That.
Financial crisis? I don't know. But that was porn searches. The bimodal distribution is much more striking for prostitution and for dating sites. So you actually see a nice winter-summer spike.
So what have we learned here?
Well, they hypothesize, and I think I agree, this is not a humans have a mating season thing. Instead, this is a vacation and a holiday effect. So it's a social and cultural phenomenon. So basically, summer and winter, this is when you have your free time. This is when you have your holidays, this is when you have your breaks. People are more likely to search for porn when it's not in the middle of the school year and they're home.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Also, those are times when you're likely to be surrounded by family and friends and people who are more likely to be asking about your relationship status and perhaps pressuring you on the subject. Your family or friends might encourage you to get a Match.com profile during the summer or during, you know, Christmas when you're forced into close proximity.
So this isn't exactly exhaustive research, but it's still neat.
It's neat, actually. And it's, what I like about it is that it's more complex when it comes to the actual data analysis. But I think it would be an interesting study for, say, like an undergraduate course. If you were doing an undergraduate course in like data analysis, for example, you could actually, you know, have your students go online. You know, let's do seasonal trends in Google searches for puppies.
Oh, that's...
by breed.
And they could pick whatever they want to search for.
Do people like Chihuahuas in April? You know, like, I think it'd be an interesting thing to, you know, teach them search methods, teach them data collection and analysis.
Okay, we are very close to out of time. So I saved the best for last. And I realize since we have run out of time, I've really only mostly talked about the sex stuff. Right. So the title of this post is Friday Weird Science Guest Post, The Distance Between Your Testicles and Your Anus, Taint Unimportant. So
this is not by me. This
no.
Yes.
This is a guest post.
Yes, and it was actually featured in the 2011, I guess that was the most recent one, edition of the Open Laboratory.
See, this is serious science, people.
Oh, yeah. It was some of the best science blogging of the year. It's by Allie Wilkinson.
Congratulations.
She did a great job.
Awesome.
You know, it takes a really excellent science writer to talk about taint.
Okay, so let's discuss that. We'll define our terms. Let's go with that. And of course, defining our terms, remembering that this show does air publicly on a variety of lovely radio stations in a variety of different time slots.
Yes, ma'am.
So what is the taint?
The taint is the perineum is the scientific term. It is the space between the testicles and the anus. And it's the colloquial term is the taint. It taint anus and it taint testicles.
All right. So why, with that out of the way, why is its length not unimportant?
There's actually several studies, particularly in animals, on the length of the taint in terms of, and they refer to it as anogenital distance.
Right.
Okay. The anogenital distance is the technical term. And it's actually very commonly used to sex rodents. So when you're breeding rodents, like rats or mice, and you're sexing them into males and females, you look at the anogenital distance. Because males and females, yes, the males have a penis, the females don't. But on very baby rats and mice, it's really hard to tell.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
They're wee.
A great deal of experience in this, and I can tell you that people make a lot of mistakes, and then you get accidents when the animals grow up. It's like, oops, there was a secret dude in there. But, the anogenital distance is much shorter for females, and it's longer for males. And it will, you know, it gets a little bit longer as they grow up. So we know that that is the case. And it's certainly the case in humans, too. But no one has studied this really in human adults. So this paper is by Eisenberg et al. And it's the relationship between anogenital distance, that's the taint, fatherhood and fertility in adult males.
How does one get someone to volunteer for this? I was assuming college students.
Actually, no. The patients were recruited from a urology clinic that specialized in reproductive medicine. So it's usually patients being evaluated for infertility and their healthy controls.
Okay, so talk about the study.
So they got a whole bunch of dudes being evaluated for infertility, and then they have a fertile control group. And the fertile control group was a prior history of paternity. So if you successfully fathered a child, you're over there.
Right.
Then they get them into what they scientifically describe as a frog-legged position. There are photos. The frog-legged position might be familiar to the females among us as the one which we are forced to take at the gynecologist, which men may have less experience.
Oh.
So then they took digital calipers and a very long-suffering doctor.
Oh.
And they measure from the back of the testicles to the anus, which was thought to be more comfortable than measuring from the base of the penis.
Well, that's nice of them.
It's very nice.
So what did this research reveal? Let's get to that.
They actually compared that. They compared the anogenital distance to the sperm count, the volume, the density, the volume of the semen per ejaculate, the density of the sperm, and the motility of the sperm. And so they got a motile sperm count. So they were comparing the anogenital distance to the male fertility. And they also looked at hormone assays, hormones like testosterone, luteinizing hormone, follicle-stimulating hormone. These influence fertility in both sexes. And they also looked at, you know, controls for age, race, you know, body mass index. Mm. So what they found is that infertile men have a significantly shorter anogenital distance when compared to men that have successfully fathered a child. It's correlated. They found that sperm density, motility, mobile sperm count, these were lower in infertile men, as you might expect, because they're infertile. And they had this shorter anogenital distance. They also had shorter stretched penis length. I'll let you think about the methods for that yourself. And they had a smaller total testicular volume than fertile men.
But as you said in your post, and I note it because it was all in caps, correlation does not equal causation.
Yes, that's Allie. That's not me.
Right. Yeah. But that's fairly important here.
Yes, it is. So these two are correlated. So you have to keep that in mind. There was no significant correlation between penis length and sperm count, so size doesn't necessarily matter. But so don't base your don't base it on the length of the penis. Base it on the taint, if you're looking.
How does but... one? You know what? We're not even gonna. No. Okay. Sigh. You are wonderful. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you.
You'll find links to Psy Curious and her blog, Neurotic Physiology, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com.
We'll be back with Phil Edwards, creator of the Fake Science website and textbook, right after this. On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we ask, why should I care about space? With a panel of people who know just how important the science of space actually is. Penny Farnassa's John Zeller and noisy astronomer Nicole Gallucci return to the show, along with Scientific American Associate Editor John Mattson and Cynthia Phillips, Senior Research Scientist at the SETI Institute. They'll discuss the technological, social, and economic benefits of exploring space and what it really means to all of us. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Phil Edwards. For the past 2 years, Phil has run the Fake Science blog from Chicago, Illinois. Using its motto, "For when the facts are too confusing," as a guide, the blog has tackled everything from high fructose corn syrup to cats. Now he's published Fake Science 101, an all-new textbook that explains the world, scientific concepts, and how to be a scientist. Thanks for being here, sir.
Thank you for having me.
So when you tell people about this book, how do you explain it?
I normally try in a couple of different levels to counteract the blank stares that I get. First, I tell them that I've written a fake science textbook. And then if they don't know what that is, I tell them that it's a little like if The Daily Show wrote about science. And then if they don't know what that is, I hopefully pull it out of my back pocket and show them. But I guess for everyone else, it's just a parody of a normal science textbook that you might get. It covers all the typical scientific disciplines as well as being a scientist and the history of science, but it doesn't have the burden of any actual research or knowledge.
Handy.
Yes, yeah. Made it a lot easier to get done.
I don't usually do this, but I really want to read just a bit of this, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, sure.
Microorganisms, making the most of a single cell. Normally, cells are just part of a bigger, more impressive organism. Sometimes, however, we pretend that they can do the work themselves. These are called microorganisms. They are all around us and probably crawling on your skin right now. A microorganism can do a lot of impressive things, especially if you are easily impressed. Though they only have one cell, a single microorganism can fill an empire, especially if that empire is made of bread or led by a really infirm, immunodeficient baby. Sir, I like you.
Thank you. You have a good, you have a very authoritative textbook voice.
Thank you.
It works well.
So this started out as a blog.
Yes, that's correct. I began it a couple of years ago, and then from there it got popular and expanded it into the textbook.
Well, why start the blog in the first place? Because you don't have a science background, do you?
No, I'm sad to admit that I don't have a science background, though that might have helped me start the blog, because basically I would walk around with a friend of mine and we would realize that pretty much everything that we saw or interacted with, we failed to actually understand, at least beyond a superficial level.
Right.
So I could explain something maybe one or two levels into it, but then you got into like, okay, where does the phone conversation actually go when it's going on the wires? How does it get turned back into a phone? And then at that point, once we were completely stumped, we just said, science, some sort of science must be involved, and left it at that. And so from there, I thought, oh, it'd be fun if I could actually explain some of these phenomena, but not have to learn it. So it kind of started from there.
So what's the response to the book been like?
It has been interesting. It's been wildly varied. A lot of people have really enjoyed it and given me feedback that both calls me on the mildest factual errors that I might have, and also appreciates or expands on things that are in the book. So that's been really cool to see. And then I've also had some experiences that I couldn't have anticipated. I've gotten requests from some teachers who have said that they want to use the book in an overhead slide in their classroom to prompt discussion and help the students realize what they shouldn't be learning. And then, oddly enough, I've also heard reports that the Houston School District has banned the textbook because they think that it might make them look bad. So it's been a really varied experience, but it's been awesome to see it unfold.
Well, I wanted to ask about the Houston School District because that is interesting. So they sent out a memo to their teachers, and it was specifically about Fake Science 101 and using it as an alternative textbook, and it was refused on the grounds that it will reflect poorly on the district.
Apparently. I have just about as much information as the reporter told me, and I sent him a reply, and then a few minutes later there was a story up, and I found out that apparently it had been banned. I imagine that what this teacher wanted to do is what teachers have done with the blog in the past, is just kind of take a little lesson. A lot of the stuff in the book is really basic. Make a either incredibly witty or corny, depending if you look at it, teacher joke about it, and then go on to the lesson. So I can't imagine that they wanted to use it as an actual textbook or anything like that. But I hope that regardless, people will still be able to check it out. I think that the knowledge will find a way to seep through no matter what.
And that's what I thought was so interesting, because I can definitely understand teachers using them the books in the way that you mentioned. And that would be a fantastic idea because, you know, let's face it, sometimes stuff is boring.
Yeah.
That's a great way to talk about it. But I just want to read a bit of this memo. This textbook is not permissible for you to distribute or your students to have. Our textbooks are not fake, and no textbook should give that impression. It would negatively impact students. So do you think that they were actually confused as to what exactly your book was?
I think they must just, whoever wrote that just might not have checked it out or read it, because it's actually a pretty G-rated book. It's not a political book in any way. I think it's pretty apolitical for the most part, or it's at least bipartisan. I think it just must be some sort of misunderstanding, and that's all I can do with it. Otherwise, I just keep putting babies drinking from beakers and move on with my life. But
well, is that good for sales? Do you hope to be banned in other districts?
Yes, as long as it's not all places, then there's no sales. If you're banned everywhere, then you're just circulated underground. It's been interesting that it's drawn attention to the book. So that's certainly been a good thing, just that more people can see it and find out about it. It's been somewhat confusing for me to see my book become tiny little missile in the culture war where it's appropriated by either side. And then you read at the end of a story about the ban, the comments from various incensed users, usually written in all caps, saying exactly how this book reflects their worldview, you know, and it's been on both sides. So that's been weird for such a silly book like this, but I'll take the attention where I can get it.
Is this book a response, I guess, in part, at least, to the seemingly anti-science state of the Western world?
It's difficult for me to think exactly how it relates to real science, largely because I become immediately self-conscious of the fact that A, I know very little science, and B, there's lots of jokes about endangering babies or eating dogs and incredibly silly stuff in the book. But if I do allow myself to pontificate, I guess it would be that the book sort of riffs off the authoritative idea of science that a lot of non-scientists have, and that occasionally creeps into the popular media or into what we as a culture view as some scientific truth. And so I guess in an indirect way, it's trying to say, hey, real science is constantly questioning, constantly skeptical of received knowledge. And so maybe by reading a book like this that's so clearly silly but looks pretty much like a real textbook, people might actually start to question those things. But again, this is all very haughty stuff for a guy who deals in Photoshop and puns about planets. So,
but I think that you're probably very right. That's a good place for many people to start.
And I mean, just speaking as a non-scientist, I admit this at the expense of my own reputation, but I thought of science as a deep-voiced, declarative statement. And in learning and kind of hanging around people who are interested in science for the past 2 years, I found out that it's much more like a spirited discussion or a debate. And I think that anything that sort of satirizes the non-scientist's impression of scientific thought draws off that misperception.
And if you look at, and again, it's just Western society that I'm talking about, there's decreased funding for science, the disappearance of effective science reporting, and kind of the general sense that people just aren't interested in evidence and facts and that kind of thing. So is that a problem to you? Do you feel this vague sense of unease that I do?
What really gets my goat, and this just might be me personally, is the pseudoscience that expands the thinnest and most conservative findings in research and makes it into a way of life for the rest of society. So it's a little different than what you're saying, but when I read a book that says why men are like alligators or something, and it's based off a one-page study that showed that alligators and humans share similar cleaning habits, or, you know, something incredibly superficial like that. That's a horrible example off the top of my head.
No, I liked it. Thank you.
That, I think, oh, this sort of pseudoscience with a really broad conclusion that somebody has slapped onto actual research is doing such a disservice to the essentially conservative, rigorous nature of actual science. And so that's what really bothers me. And I see so much of it that it's something that I do take the occasional jab at in the book, and that frustrates me.
Will that be the subject of your next book, perchance?
Well,
I read that.
I've told a couple of people that I want to do a mashup life science book. It'll be called Imagine Moonwalking with Einstein While Blinking, and it'll my little lair, Adwell 4, etc. on and on mashup where I take something and say how it should govern your entire life, even though the original researchers didn't intend it at all. So that's a rather arcane thing that I end up obsessing about.
I support that kind of obsession, sir, because that is the kind of thing that I would love to have on the show.
Well, I'll get to work on that.
Well, thanks for being here, Phil, and for the book.
Thank you. Thanks for reading it.
You can find a link to Phil Edwards and Fake Science 101 at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, so that you know what we're up to, and to iTunes, so that you can subscribe to the show or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're Skeptically Speaking.